The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to this installment of The Dan Proft Show. Follow us on danproftshow.com, on social media, at Dan Proft Show, as well as at Dan Proft, Facebook and Twitter, and Instagram is the reverse, at Proft underscore Dan or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, you know how to find me on social media if you want to. Appreciate you joining us for another installment of our show in this coronavirus era, this crisis that we're dealing with, trying to get information, answer the questions, get answers to the questions that we know and distribute them, as well as exercise some restraint. Be measured in what we, with respect to what we don't know, and continue to just plod along in that fashion, be rational about these things. Interesting interview given by the director of the National Institute for Health, The Atlantic. This is in The Atlantic, theatlantic.com. There are estimates that if nothing goes right, if we fail to flatten the curve, and if health systems are overwhelming, we might see deaths as many as 1.5 million people in the United States. So this modeling and these predictions with these contingencies, of course, get people all whipped up. There was another one. Just have to report it because it's circulating. Report from the Imperial College of London warning that 2.2 million Americans and 510,000 Brits could die from coronavirus if extreme action isn't taken to change the course of the outbreak. Well, okay, so what's extreme action? Largely what you see being done in one form or fashion around the country. Francis Collins, going back to him, the director of NIH, as I said, the extreme action, the next 8 weeks or so, the more extreme version of social distancing is his extreme action. Okay. Well, what is that? For example, today, Governor Cuomo, New York, announced that there will be a prohibition on non-essential businesses requiring more than 50% of their workforce to report for duty. So if you're a designated, if you're not a designated essential business, if you're a non-essential business in New York State, you can only have 50% of your employees show up by order of the governor. And of course, in France and in Italy and in Pennsylvania, for that matter, we've seen even more drastic action than that. What should we be doing? When will we have a sense whether or not it's working? And how do we know how we're doing, in the words of Tony Fauci, in flattening the curve? Well, let's put some of these questions to our friend Dr. Kevin Pham, who is, not in addition to being a medical doctor, is a contributor to Daily Signal and a former graduate fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Pham, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
So is extreme social distancing, or the more extreme versions of social distancing, is that the highest, best thing that Americans can do, as per what these other professionals are saying?
I mean, if you're talking about what the best thing that can be done is to prevent disease spread, then it is to eliminate all human contact from one another, right? If you're talking about the most maximal thing, so we have to have that as like our ceiling. It's going to be unrealistic to have that level of, like, we don't want to well people into their houses. Like, we have seen some reports that have been in some of the early control efforts in China. But, you know, we're going to be doing something short of that. If we're talking about the best thing that we can do to prevent disease spread, it is to limit human contact with one another. And the reason for that is COVID-19, it spreads to, on average, 2 to 4 people each time it infects a person. And so, as you can imagine, it will double up its the cases really quickly without anyone even noticing, and then we won't get a chance to even catch it if we're not doing something proactive to prevent the spread from one person to the next.
Yeah, I think people need to understand how that, you know, think about this algorithmically, which is not normally the way people think. And so, you know, if you infect, what's its R naught number is like 2.5 people. So if you infect 2.5 people versus even reducing that to 1.5, reducing that to 0.5, you go from this over the course of 15 days infecting, being the person who's the instigator to infect hundreds of people, to being a person that just infected a couple of people. So it really makes a material difference, you know, the distancing that you can do that reduces the likelihood of infecting others.
Right. And as a case in point, most of the coronavirus that has been sequenced in the Washington area, most of it is linked back to a single progenitor strain. Because, you know, as the virus infects one person to the next person, it mutates a little bit. But then they sequenced enough of them that they found that a large portion of the cluster in Washington state links back to a Wuhan strain. And we know that one person, the first confirmed case in the United States, was a man who had traveled from Wuhan, China. And so there's a pretty good reason to believe that that person caused the majority of the cluster in Washington state. And Washington state right now has over 1,000 cases, I believe. The number keeps updating daily, but I think it's up to 1,000 now. So just looking at that, since mid-January to now, we have over 1,000 cases and several tens of deaths, I think, possibly over 100 deaths in Washington state. And that is because of that logarithmic growth of the infection potential. And it's really important that social distancing is about reducing that R0 figure, because right now it's somewhere between 2 and 4. You cited 2.5. If we can get that down, by social distancing, you limit the potential for spread. So if you get that down to 1, then it only replaces itself, right? So that would level off the number of cases in America if we can get down the R0 to 1. For long enough to get people cured. Then the disease starts to retreat. If we get it below one,
then we're on the other side of that flattened curve that we want to be on the other side of as quickly as possible. I wanted to get your reaction to some of the reports, because they're a bit murky what you make of them. Reports of people in China being infected a second time. So they were infected, they were treated, they were released, and then they tested positive again. They caught it again. There's one or two cases in Japan as well that were reported again, although the details are murky. And this is one of the things that would otherwise distinguish it from other viruses.
Yeah, I've seen some of those reports too. I haven't seen enough of a study to suggest that this stands a really good chance of mutating enough that it causes a reinfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not 100% sure. As in, I haven't read enough studies to suggest that we're not building an immune system, immune response to this. By what I have read, that we do build an immune response to this. What it could be is, in China especially, there's a high rate of smoking and there's a lot of air pollution. And both of those things contribute to a diminished immune response. So it could be that some people are just not building up the antibodies to the virus and are able to get reinfected after they recover.
And there's some suggestion too that it may be faulty testing as well. You have a false negative or something like that as well.
That is a potential, but I suspect for people who are reinfected later, they probably were monitored for virus presence as they were hospitalized. And when they're hospitalized, when they're being tested, the test is a little bit more accurate just because, one, you have a higher viral load as you're being tested, and two, they might be using, I don't know what their protocols are over there, but especially if they're in the ICU, they would be using what's called bronchoalveolar lavage or fluids from deep in the lungs to find the virus, and that would be a very accurate test. However, you did bring up a good point. The nasal swab, if someone was hospitalized but not in the ICU, if you were nasal swab, the sensitivity, of, at least in the early testing in China, was up to, I think it was up to 70% for nasal swabs. So that's like a 30% chance of getting a false negative. So that is a possibility.
When we come back with Dr. Kevin Pham, I want to talk a little bit, sort of resetting the table here. We've gotten a little bit far afield from it, but the difference between coronavirus and the flu, since so many comparisons have been made, particularly to H1N1 from a little bit more than a decade ago, and also the handle, sort of the see something, say something handle on coronavirus, which is we should all behave like we're a carrier. More with Dr. Kevin Pham, who's also a contributor to the Daily Signal, right after this.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking to Dr. Kevin Pham, who is, in addition to being a medical doctor, a contributor to the Daily Signal, former graduate fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. And Dr. Pham, we should all behave like we're infected, maybe asymptomatically, but we should behave like we're infected. We should walk around like we could infect someone else. Is that a good way to position it?
That is one way, and I think it's a pretty good way of framing the this whole situation. All of us could be carriers, and none of us could know it. Well, I won't say none of us, but it's easy to carry this and be young and not know that you have any virus in you. And then that's how the majority of the spread has occurred. People who are asymptomatic are encountering other people and then spreading the disease to them without showing any signs or symptoms. It would be important to behave like this, but it's also important to know that even if you're not infected and even if you are around people that you think are not infected, they may be infected, but it's also, all this is contributing to the effort to prevent that human-to-human contact that I was talking about earlier. And we all have to take an effort in this together, otherwise it's not going to work. Like all those projections, the 1.5, 2.2 million people who may be killed, those are worst-case scenarios.
Right.
One of them is the 2.2 million is an absolute worst-case scenario. We do absolutely nothing. But we have to keep in mind that if we are very cavalier about this, if we just walk around blithely, then that will become a reality if we don't take it seriously. But we have a great chance right now to make that only a worst case scenario and not a realistic scenario. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so just to put a fine point on that too, especially for people that are a little bit younger who are. Feel like they're more bulletproof, as many people have commented. We all understand what it was like to be young when we thought we were going to live forever and nothing could hurt us. The difference between COVID-19 and the flu, this COVID-19 is not just another flu, both in terms of just its categorization, but more importantly, in terms of its impact and its contagiousness. And I just wanted you to develop the distinguishing factors.
Right. As you mentioned, it is literally not the flu. It's an entirely different virus, whereas H1N1 is an influenza virus. But another thing is that the seasonal flu, it's essentially we're behind on catching up to the flu. One of the problems that we have with the flu is that it can reassort itself and become a new virus each year. So it's a bit late to stop influenza, and it does kill all those people every single year. I think we're over 10,000 this year. We have a chance to stop, like, I think we might be able to stop COVID-19, like, flatten its tracks by the end of the year, possibly the end of next year. We could stop, and if we could do that, we can save potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives going into the future. That is a little optimistic. I don't know if we'll be able to actually do that, but but if we have the chance to stop it, we should stop it. But taking this down to the personal level, you know, young people are thinking that they're not affected by this virus. That's not true. Young people are unlikely to be affected by this virus, and that's a completely different thing. So if, you know, if there's a 1% chance that there's a 1% chance that a young person might become severely ill with the disease, well, just look at your Facebook friends list. If you have over 100 friends, one of those people might die from this virus. You know, that's not something that we can take lightly. It's a pretty big chance. And then furthermore, if you get this virus, people who are dying from this virus in Washington State especially, we've seen a lot of people are dying not from the respiratory disease. They're dying because their heart stops. They're dying of a heart attack. So what it looks like this virus is doing is it's getting into other parts of the body. So even if this virus gets into you, causes a mild illness, and you get better, we don't know that the virus has not also infected your heart or your lungs, your liver. Like it could cause long-term sequelae after this.
Well, and to your point, there was a report in the New York Post, a Belgian doctor working to battle the coronavirus says he's treated several seriously ill young patients between the ages of 30 and 50 presenting with severe symptoms. And he said they just walk in. They're terribly affected by the virus. He said the CT scans indicated severe lung damage. The images we took yesterday are nothing short of terrifying, he said, about the lung damage he has seen in some of his patients.
Yeah, the virus, I don't want to get into the cellular, the molecular biology of this, but the virus has, it enters the cell on a certain receptor that's found predominantly or found most abundantly in the lungs. And so as it's going into the cell, it's also damaging them. And it's hard to tell if there will be long-term damage. But it looks like that's the case because a lot of patients who are recovering in Hong Kong have found that they have lingering diminished lung capacity. And so, like, just because you're not affected now doesn't mean you won't get affected later. We see something similar with measles, for instance, what's called, panencephalitis. It's a longer word than just that, but several decades after people getting the measles, there's a chance that they develop a neurodegenerative disease that eats up their nervous system, and then they eventually die from that. So it's a possibility that you may get some kind of disease from this virus decades after the fact. It's not impossible. Unlikely, but it's not impossible. So we need to take this seriously, not just for our vulnerable populations, but also for ourselves, because it may affect us later on in the future, and it may just affect us now, like you just mentioned. Those people are not typically what you'd consider vulnerable population.
Right, and there was no underlying condition. And then that Belgian doctor said these were people who did not smoke, had no other conditions such as diabetes or heart failure underlying the infection. But I want to go back to something you said, too, about the possibility of actually stopping this virus by the year's end or by the end of this the season. And when you say that, you mean so that coronavirus or COVID-19, at least this strain, would not be part of our new normal attendant to the flu next winter, for example?
Right. We don't necessarily know enough to make that, to say that with certainty, but we have nothing to suggest right now. We have nothing to suggest that this will become a seasonal disease like the flu has. So there's a vaccine that's in the works right now. You know, if we can make it long enough to get the vaccine out and start vaccinating everybody, there's a chance that this just becomes, it might not disappear entirely, but it might fade into the background such that it doesn't affect us on a daily life, doesn't affect us annually. That's a possibility. We don't know that's for sure, but we have an opportunity to make it so.
And with respect to those people who say, you know, with the economic impact this is having, that based on the numbers we see right now, the response of the shuttering of businesses and the shutdowns of, you know, entire cities and states and countries, this is an overreaction economically, and it's going to do long-term economic damage that's not commensurate with the threat. What do you say?
It is certainly a heavy-handed approach, and it will certainly have economic damage. We can say that for sure. But we can also say that this will certainly help. You know, just these are the things that are being shut down are, you know, nexuses for human activity. And if you shut down human social activity where people are interacting with one another, you will certainly decrease the spread of disease. Whether this is the right option or the wrong option, I don't think that's the right question to ask right now, just because it is happening, and short of like an impeachment or a recall of a mayor or governor, there's nothing that we can really do about it. So I just think for right now, we should just focus on the fact that we're not we are limiting the spread of disease with these actions. There is some good that comes out of it.
He is Dr. Kevin Pham. In addition to being a medical doctor, he's a contributor to the Daily Signal, former graduate fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Pham, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We spoke with investigative journalist Cheryl Atkison on yesterday's show about the good, the bad, and the lazy of the Beltway Press Corps' reporting on coronavirus. And there's certainly some good examples of good reporting, and we noted some of them. But the misreporting and the unwillingness to correct statements that are materially false continues unabated because, of course, it's very difficult for those who have defined themselves as part of the Trump resistance to acknowledge the truth, much less confer any credit. There are exceptions, though, and I'd like to point them out in the interest of being even-handed. Dana Bash yesterday on CNN, after the president's coronavirus task force briefing, Dana Bash had this to say about the president's tone and temperament at that briefing.
This was remarkable from the president of the United States. This is a nonpartisan. This is an important thing to note and to applaud from an American standpoint, from a human standpoint. He is being the kind of leader that people need, at least in tone, today and yesterday, right. In tone that people need and want and yearn for in times of crisis and uncertainty.
And then, of course, she was immediately excoriated and flamed on Twitter and everywhere else to ensure she will never say such things again. And then on top of that, a little bit later in the day, you had the report that the Trump administration had rejected a test that was made available to from the World Health Organization, a coronavirus test several weeks back. Responding to that report, Admiral Brett Gara, who is the Assistant Secretary for Health at HHS, no one ever offered a test that we refused. This was a research-grade test that was not approved, not submitted to the FDA. There was a small number that we had greatly surpassed in a very short period of time. The World Health Organization test was developed soon after Chinese researchers publicly posted the genome of the coronavirus back in January, shipped to millions of tests to countries around the world, but generally only those without the capacity to develop their own. So again, more effort to try to lay blame to the spread of the coronavirus on the doorstep of the president, but largely without merit. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend John Hinderaker, president of the Center for the American Experiment, and, of course, contributor to powerlineblog.com. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be with you.
You've picked up on this, too, and posted about it over at powerlineblog.com, that the media just can't help itself with some of these stories.
Well, that's right. It goes back to before Trump was even inaugurated. I mean, the resistance has been going on since November of 2016. And these people are completely shameless. They lie without apology. They just viciously malign the president day after day after day. And it can't help. You know, I think that they've been doing it for so long and they've been proven wrong so many times. I'm not sure it's very effective anymore, but it certainly isn't helping.
Well, and there are other examples of this, too. I mean, Sunday, CNN, Chiron read Trump on coronavirus from hoax to national emergency. This is one of the lines they keep repeating, as you say, without shame or embarrassment. He never said that coronavirus was a hoax. He said that the media's attempt from the early days to present to blame him, to suggest he had a lethargic response, to blame him for allowing it to metastasize and spread, is what the hoax was. But it doesn't matter. They know that, but they repeat the lie anyway.
No, that's right. On Powerline, I wrote about a particular instance in the New York Times, or from one of the members of the editorial board of the New York Times, a woman named Mara Gay.
The mathematician.
Who is best remembered.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mathematician. So she got the transcript of a call that the president had with governors. This is a couple of days ago now. And she tweeted this. She tweeted, Trump told governors this morning they are on their own.
Right.
Quote, respirators, ventilators, all of the equipment, try getting it yourselves. Close quote, Mr. Trump told the governors during the conference call. Now, this is something that we didn't used to see. She puts this in quotation marks, but in fact, that's not what Trump said. And of course, it got corrected. I cited Dan Bongino, and what he really said was, quote, we will be backing you, but try getting it yourselves. Point of sales, much better, much more direct if you can get it yourself. In other words, don't wait for the feds. You know, you may have a better opportunity to get some of these products than we do. Because of the federal bureaucracy,
and of course, they knew that too. They knew that Pence and the team had been scrambling 3M to produce more masks, to green light masks for use that are normally used only for industrial purposes. So she knew that, or should have known it.
Yeah, but this is so fundamental because, you know, it is a cardinal rule of journalism that you don't put something in quotation marks unless it is exactly what a person said. And here, this is a member of the New York Times editorial board. Yeah. You know, she puts this in quotation marks. Well, no, that's not what he said at all. I mean, we didn't used to see this kind of journalistic malpractice, but now it has gotten ubiquitous.
When we come back with John Hinderaker, I want to talk a little bit about politics. We've got to talk in the context of Joe Biden, some further cementing his position as the nominee for president. After another handful of primaries yesterday. More with John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, right after this.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Prof, and this is The Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. We're speaking with John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, a contributor to powerlineblog.com. And John, Joe Biden cleans up as anticipated in Arizona and Illinois and Florida. Clear is he the nominee of the Democrat Party that I think Hillary Clinton right now is second in the betting sites in terms of likelihood to be the nominee. Bernie Sanders is third. So now that we've got the matchup pretty much set, how would you frame this race? And I know it's difficult because everything is going to be coronavirus for the foreseeable future. But how would you frame this race, generally speaking, if you're President Trump?
Well, you know, here's my concern, Dan. I mean, I think that government at all levels is overreacting to the coronavirus. I don't think it was necessary to shut down our economy and plunge the country into a recession and then try to make up for it by saying you're going to mail out checks to millions of people and you're going to subsidize businesses and bail out the airlines and so on. I think they shouldn't have destroyed the economy in the first place. And unfortunately, it seems to me that is taking almost off the table the best argument for Trump's reelection, which is the strong economy that we have had as a result of his policies. So, I'm afraid that what's happened here over the last few weeks gives Joe Biden, amazingly enough, an outside shot at what otherwise I would have said was going to be a landslide win for President Trump.
Well, and it presents him the opportunity to make sure that the election is completely about Trump, not about his competence, not about his self-dealing that Peter Schweitzer documented in his most recent book. But it's all about you crater the economy. Well, you know, I had support to do everything I did, Trump will say, and so on and so forth. We had to take evasive action, but we wouldn't have had to take evasive action if you had acted earlier. So Biden has all of these sort of what if arguments he could make that it's impossible to sort of prove or unprove because all you can deal with is the aftermath. And it seems unlikely, according to most economists and those who have a little bit of life experience, that we can go through a couple, 3 months of what we've gone through for the last couple of weeks. And then somewhere between August and November, you're going to have a 180 with respect to our economy.
I think it's a given that we've been put into a recession, in my opinion, needlessly. The way I see this shaping up, though, Dan, I mean, I The only thing, I mean, well, to step back for a moment, I think early on Trump did exactly the right thing. He took the action that was relevant and helpful by stopping travel between the U.S. and China,
right.
And he was criticized on that was racist and xenophobic. No,
right.
It was prescient. He did the one thing that was really important to do back in January. At the same time, he tried to be reassuring. He was saying, don't panic, you know, we're getting the data on this. But he was trying to, you know, tamp down panic. And at some point, they realized that just wasn't going to work and that he was going to get pounded on for not doing enough, for not being hysterical enough, you know, in his response to this virus. And so they decided, all right, the heck with it. And they just went over the top. And it's not just the federal level. In fact, even more so at the state and local level. I mean, you know, stores have shut down, restaurants have been shut down, bars, businesses, you know, the economy is basically ground to a halt. But I think that in the context of the presidential election, the only thing that Trump can be criticized for is not doing enough, right? And that's where Biden will try to go. But given the hysteria that we've seen, and given the draconian measures that have been taken, I don't think Biden can get any traction with an argument that the administration hasn't done enough. I think the administration has done too much. The problem is that a recession is a recession.
Right.
And there's a lot of votes that would have been there for Trump on the basis of a strong economy. That now, you know, maybe just don't see that as a big motivation.
Right. And so it makes the perception of his handling of this that much more important, because now, assuming a recession, as you say, and assuming some difficult economic times going into November, you're going to essentially have to say, yeah, he was hit with this exogenous event. And I'll tell you what, it's tough. But he handled it competently. I have confidence in him. And if he can handle that, then he can bring us back in 2021 and beyond. I mean, that's essentially the argument he's going to have to make, right?
I think it is. And to look on the optimistic side, in any time of crisis, what people want is a strong executive, a strong leader. And if you put Donald Trump next to Joe Biden and you say, which of these two is the strong leader that you want to follow at a time of crisis, it's not Joe Biden. You know?
Well, and, yeah.
And so one other... I'm still optimistic about the election, but I certainly wish that the response had not been so draconian.
And one other piece of pushback that is available to Trump is, you know, the guy next to me, he's for open borders. Remember how the EU shut down their borders and Canada shut down its border? And it turns out that borders are really important. And he and his party are the open borders crowd. So are you sure you want to go down that road?
Well, I think that's exactly right, Dan. I also think that what this really proves is that Trump was right about China all along. I think in the medium
right.
term and the long term, this is going to accelerate the trend that we've already been seeing to companies bringing their manufacturing back to the United States. There are huge downsides to doing business in China. They're becoming blindingly obvious. And I think if I were Trump in the election, I would take credit over and over again for having been right about China.
Oh, and how about going back to what we were talking about before the break, the media in this country, how about the Chinese foreign minister just announcing all the press passes for the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, they're pulled. You have 10 days to get out of the country. So it's going to be a little bit difficult for our press corps in this country to be flacking for China the way that Tom Friedman would like them to.
You know, I think flacking for China is hopeless. You know, just like, you know, the idea, you know, when Trump canceled travel between China and the U.S., denounced as racist, xenophobic, I think that's a non-starter. I think people get it, you know, that there are risks to globalization. There are risks to having your economy intertwined with that of a rather primitive country like China, as I think more people now recognize, ruled by a brutal dictatorship.
Yeah,
that's not, you know, there are issues with that.
Chinese communists aren't the friends of the Chinese people, and they're not our friends either. Yeah, that's the important takeaway. John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor to PowerlineBlog.com. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show, updating President Trump's pronouncements, along with those members of his coronavirus task force from this morning's briefing. President Trump making a number of announcements, including the invocation of the Defense Production Act in the event that he needs it.
We'll be invoking the Defense Production Act just in case we need it. And it can do a lot of good things if we need it. And we will have it all completed, signing it in just a little while.
And this, perhaps, with respect to expanding production of hospital masks and protective gear for medical workers. He talked as well about meeting with the nurses subsequent to the briefing, probably a related topic. And I'll get back to the Defense Production Act in a second.
This afternoon, I'll be meeting with nurses on the front lines of the battle against the virus. They're truly American heroes. They want to get it done. They're incredible people. So we're going to be meeting with nurses.
So the Defense Production Act dates back to 1950, and it's been invoked by a number of presidents between then and now, starting with Truman during the Korean War. Essentially, there's three component parts to it. Can authorize the president to require businesses to sign contracts deemed necessary for national defense. Can authorize the president to establish mechanisms, regulations, orders, agencies to allocate materials, services, facilities in advance of our national defense. And the third section authorizes the president to control the civilian economy so that scarce and critical materials necessary for the national defense are available for defense needs. And this is where you had, for example, wage and price controls instituted by Harry Truman. There are limits to this, thankfully. Supreme Court decision in 1952 in the Youngstown Steel and Tube case, where President Truman essentially sought to nationalize a steel operation without any congressional authorization. The Supreme Court said that was bridged too far. And again, hopefully there won't be the need for federal imposition here, signing it in the event that he needs it, said the president, with the cooperation he's gotten in this public-private partnership on testing as well as material production. The announcement in a previous briefing about, for example, 3M producing using the masks that they produce for industrial purposes and getting the FDA to waive regulations for use for medical purposes, that sort of thing, rather than having the federal government come in and run production schedules at particular facilities. But that was an important note. There's a couple others, but let's get to one more here. And that is President Trump announcing that he would be closing the border except for, closing the border to non-essential travel but not trade with our Canadian neighbors to the north.
What side? Then Monday you said no, we're not considering closing.
No, I said not yet. I spoke with the Prime Minister, Trudeau. Very good relationship, obviously, between us and our two countries. And no tipping point. It's just that we want to isolate from the standpoint we don't want people coming into contact, because that's the way we're going to win this war. That is so important.
And President Trump added that he hoped it would be no longer than 30 days.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, @DanProft and @DanProftShow. Again, we're going to talk a little bit on the economic health side, but an important part of yesterday's briefing with the president and the entire panoply of his coronavirus response team was talking economics before Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin had to leave to go talk economics with Senate Republicans. Here's what the Treasury Secretary said about the sort of employee stimulus that the administration is conceiving: cash in the hands of everyday Americans.
Although the president likes the idea of the payroll tax holiday, I will tell you what we've heard from many people, and the president has said we can consider this. The payroll tax holiday would get people money over the next 6 to 8 months. We're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. And what we've heard from hardworking Americans, many companies have now shut down, whether it's bars or restaurants. Americans need cash now, and the president wants to get cash now. And I mean now, in the next 2 weeks.
How much?
I will be previewing that with the Republicans. There's some numbers out there. They may be a little bit bigger than what's in the press.
Mm-hmm. The overall number was coming in around $1 trillion in addition to what the Senate is intent on passing that they received from the House, as McConnell explained yesterday. Mnuchin also restated the administration's commitment to backstop the airlines, seeking $50 billion are the airlines.
I've had discussions with all the airline CEOs this week. The airline CEOs have had conversations with the Senate and the House. As the president said, I was up with a subset of the Republican senators last night. I've discussed that with them. I think, as you know, this is worse than 9/11. For the airline industry, this is they are almost ground to a halt. The president wants to make sure that although we don't want people to travel unless it's critical, we want to maintain for critical travel the right to have domestic travel.
And the president has met with fast food company executives. He's met with hoteliers and travel industry folks, some of the industries that, of course, are obviously hardest hit in the immediacy of these shutdowns around the country. Important to note, as the Wall Street Journal did, that the $50 billion rescue for the airlines looks to be structured as secured loans rather than just grant money. And that's important because the Fed also took the journal's advice yesterday in moving to relaunch its primary dealer credit facility, which was utilized during the 2008 crisis to provide liquidity to businesses. And the idea of just throwing money around as grant money that shall not be repaid, well, then you just have everybody queue up for a bailout, right? Why does one sector, one business get a bailout and another one doesn't? To do it in the way of extending credit or providing secured loans, that's a different story. And there's responsibility on the borrower side, which is a good thing, you know, all things considered in the context of this crisis. For more on what the administration is conceiving and the arguments that are being made, as well as an assessment of the damage yet to be done, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of Trumponomics. Let's talk some Trumponomics, Steve. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan.
So what do you like and not like from what's being bandied about by the Trump administration?
First of all, I agree with what you just said, Dan. In fact, I was one of the people with Laffer and Steve Forbes urging that any relief that you give right now, it's going to be temporary. This is going to be over with in hopefully 3 months. So you want to make it a loan that has to be repaid, not a grant, where, as you said, people just line up for the free money. So what businesses need right now is you've got, you know, millions of companies that were financially healthy, you know, a month ago that are now going to face a total crash, a cash crunch. And you want to make sure they have the funds to be able to meet their payroll and not to have a you know, fire sale on their assets. So I think it's quite appropriate for the government to open up its lending window for companies that can't get a loan from a bank and that have collateral, you know, that can actually pay back the loan. And I think that's a smart thing to do, and I think it'll prevent layoffs and bankruptcies. I do not like the idea of $1,000. By the way, is it $1,000 per household or per person or per worker?
It's pending. What? Yeah, right.
Per person, that's a lot of money. So that's a stupid idea. The government can only give people money if it takes away money from people, right? I mean, sometimes politicians lose the most obvious laws of economics. Dan, if we're on a two-person island, it's you and me, and you're going to get $1,000. The only other person the $1,000 can come from is me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we make these things too complicated. It's never smart to just give people free money. As our hero, Milton Friedman, used to say, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, and there's no such thing as free money.
We've been through this before with the direct cash payment. Pelosi and Bush did it in 2008,
yeah.
and it doesn't work.
Let me just make one quick point here.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought this up because I have a piece that'll be in the Wall Street Journal with Art Laffer tomorrow saying The 2009, if you listen to the rhetoric that's going on, the narrative from liberals, they're like, well, let's do what Obama did in 2009. Now, why? That didn't work. It was a complete – the 2009 stimulus, remember when we spent $830 billion? That actually made the economy worse. It didn't help the economy. It inhibited the recovery. And what the point I'm making is we shouldn't put in policies today that'll make it harder for the U.S. economy to recover in, you know, 2 or 3 or 5 months.
Right. No, that's right. So, you know, understand what things are and what they aren't when you propose them. And it there needs to be clarity about what, if we do this, here's the expected result. It's not going to be stimulative as the likes of Pelosi are arguing. She thinks unemployment insurance is stimulative. But
remember she said, yes. She said unemployment insurance and food stamps are the best way to help the economy. Like, how is giving somebody a welfare payment for not working going to cause more people to work? I mean, well, it's just so absurd on the face of it.
Well, another way to do this too, and this was argued by an economics professor who writing for the Cato Institute, is use the existing social welfare programs we have, expand them to provide any sort of one-time or temporary payment to families that otherwise would meet some sort of eligibility requirement. So you're just not willy-nilly sending people, sending you know, people making hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, $1,000 a person. Why would you do that?
Oh, well, here's the other thing. How do you help somebody who's lost their job or for the next 2 months? You know, I'm sitting at home right now. I mean, Heritage Foundation is closed down. You know, it's going to be now. I'm lucky enough to still be able to get a paycheck. I'm working from home, but a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. Make everything a loan. Make everything a loan. So somebody can't get through the next couple months. Give them $1,500. But you know what? When this thing is over with, you're going to have to pay back that $1,500. You know why? Because then you're not. Then only people who really need the money are going to sign up for it.
Let's talk about bigger ideas than just sort of the usual Keynesian stimulus proposals,
which never work.
Amity Schlaes and Brian Westbury had a piece of Real Clear Politics the other day, arguing that this is an opportunity, like you're saying, you know, and this is an opportunity for the left to try to expand the welfare state permanently. This is also an opportunity for us to show the American people who are confused what capitalism looks like and how incentives work. What about massively cutting, say, for example, the capital gains tax? What about moving in that direction to provide irresistible incentive to engage in productive economic activity?
If you ask me, if I were king for a day and I could do anything to get us out of this crisis and to make sure the economy snaps back, I would just eliminate the income tax for the next year and a half. Just eliminate the income tax. That's the capital gains tax, all of it. And then, you know, you're giving people incredible incentives to grow the economy. Businesses would snap back in a minute. What we want to see is what's called a V-shape. We're going to have a recession, no question about it. I mean, you've got, you know, at least 20 to 30% of the economy that's shut down right now. So there is going to be a recession, and it's going to be deep and it's going to be painful. Hopefully it won't be long. And what you want is what's called a V-shape, so that as soon as it's over, the economy just soars upward. And setting in place those kinds of policies, I think, makes a lot of sense. If that's not entirely different from what Laffer, Kudlow, and Forbes and I endorsed yesterday, which is the suspension of the payroll tax, because that gives in to think about it, you know, that gives incentives for employers to hire people, right, because their cost of hiring a worker is lower, and it gives incentives for workers to work more because every additional dollar they make, they get to keep more of the money they earn. So, yeah, I think that those kinds of measures make a lot of sense. I just wonder whether you could get a capital gains tax cut passed right now.
That's
just a tax cut for billionaires.
Well, okay, but I mean, but you know, like Mitch McConnell is signaled yesterday a willingness to swallow hard and be bipartisan. You know, turnabout is fair play.
That's what makes me nervous.
Well, I understand,
every idea Nancy Pelosi has is a bad idea.
I know, so, but my point is to say, use this opportunity to leverage back, rather than just accept the Keynesian nonsense that you get from the usual suspects. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Get through this.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Of course, this is a global pandemic that includes the United States, and so it's interesting to watch the reactions and note the extent of the outbreaks in other countries. The EU moving to shut down their borders. I guess border security does matter. I guess it is a real thing. I guess borders do exist. The free movement of labor is one thing, not requiring visas like in the Schengen zone. But when it comes to protecting your populace, a lot of the open borders crowd all of a sudden realize they have borders and they need to be shuttered or certainly tightly regulated. People tested coming in if you're going to allow people in. Just remember, come November in this country, open borders will be on the ballot in the form of Joe Biden and the Democrats. Israelis with coronavirus have been quarantined. 427 of them. There is Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of Britain, taking more drastic action. 1.4 million Brits told they must stay in for 12 weeks. Over 70s, those who are pregnant, anyone with underlying health conditions should try not to leave their homes if they can and avoid crowded spaces immediately. This is, in part is because of a report, and this is, again, modeling, a report from Imperial College London that warned that as many as 2.2 million Americans and 510,000 Brits could die from coronavirus if extreme action isn't taken to change the course of the outbreak. Those numbers are predicated on not doing things that are already being done. And it's modeling. And again, we're going to have our models or and the models globally, but particularly our models informed as you have a million test kits rolling out up to 1.9 million by week's end. You get more test results. You adjust your models accordingly with real world sample data. So that will be important. But these reports are coming out. It's going to stoke more panic. It's going to stoke more fear. It's going to stoke more frayed nerves. So we just have to deal with them head on. But I wanted to talk to a friend of ours from Strange Brewland, north of the border, which is, by the way, shut down. Because, interestingly, Canada mirrors America in a number of ways, including with sort of a federalist system. They have the central government and they have the provincial governments. We have the central government. We have our state government. So to help us do that, get a handle on what's happening north of the border, Alan Thickworld, we're pleased to be joined by Jerry Agar, our friend from Toronto, Toronto Sun columnist, host of the Jerry Agar Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Jerry, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you kept making all those references. You missed Wayne Gretzky, but I thought I'd throw him in.
Is Wayne Gretzky, is he more of a national hero than Alan Thicke? That doesn't seem right.
Well, it's true, though.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, because he plays hockey.
Yes,
listen,
I've
when
heard.
You're mentioning about the border, Dan, here's the thing you'll love. They're going to start tightening the border up on non-essential travel. But we have a problem in Canada with numbers of people who are coming to the United States from other nations and then coming across a not well-protected border into Canada illegally, and they're not going to stop that.
So they're not going to stop that. They're not going to stop those border crossings, but they're going to stop. Okay, that makes sense because it's political. We have to maintain the appearance of open borders, even at the expense of public health. That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's right. Like maybe you're a Canadian studying in the United States. No, you can't come back. Oh, wait a minute. Here's somebody from a plague-infested country. Yeah, we'll let you in. It's insane.
You heard me mentioning sort of the competing federalist systems. How is it working with sort of the central government guidelines like we're getting here and then versus what each province may or may not do?
Well, Ontario yesterday at about 8:30 in the morning declared a state of emergency. And a little bit later, there was a speech from the Prime Minister talking about the possibility of financial aid to people who've been ordered not to work, et cetera. And he led off by mentioning that Ontario had declared a state of emergency. And he said that was the right thing to do, which I took it to be nudge, nudge, wink, wink to the other provincial governments. Maybe you guys should do that, too, so I don't have to.
Is it sort of working at the trajectory it's working here where schools, then bars and restaurants. Now you've got big cities that are moving to shut down all non-essential existence. Generally speaking, are you sort of on that same trajectory?
Sure, and it changes almost hour to hour. This would actually be a spring break for the schools, and so they were out this week anyway. But before we even got into this week, they announced that that's going to be extended for an additional 2 weeks. So that's when the teachers booked the trips to Florida.
And what's the extent of the outbreak there and the Canadian healthcare system's ability to handle it at this point?
You know, I was looking at some numbers, Dan, this morning because I had heard somebody on our morning show say, well, we've handled this so much better than the United States. And I thought, I don't think that's true. And so I was looking at the numbers, and it's interesting that am I right that you have around 6,000 cases right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have 598 with 10% of the population. So it seems like it's pretty much exactly the same. We've had, I think we're up to 8 deaths now, and half of those were at one senior citizen's home.
You mentioned on the economic side, obviously, this is causing quite the disruption in the day-to-day economies of big countries like Canada and the United States. A whole raft of proposals is being, well, some of it's being advanced in our Congress and other things being proposed, both on the demand side as well as the supply side, on the employee side as well as the employer side. What are you guys talking about specifically and what the government is going to do to try to help employers and employees marshal through this period?
The details are not there in terms of if you have been mandated not to work, how you're going to access this capital. We're also expecting that they'll move the date for filing taxes without penalty, that right. sort of thing. I mean, ultimately, the banks are going to get their money, I think. But what they might do is say, okay, well, we won't give you penalties at the front end here if you need to either just pay a bit or not pay your mortgage for a little while, and we'll work it out at the other end. Like that kind of stuff is very fluid right now, but certainly it's happening as it is happening there, I guess.
Airlines as well, backstopped.
Yeah, some people aren't as happy about that, actually, because people don't like the airlines to start with.
Yeah, well, right. But I mean, obviously, you understand the vitality to
sure.
the economy. And so, I mean, it's sort of the same thing here. And interestingly, too, I mean, some of these nuances are important because if you're going to start bailing out particular industries, throwing money around to particular industries, then everybody gets in line. And what it was proposed by the Trump administration, for example, with the airlines, is secured loans through the Treasury, not just grant money. And that's a big difference when you talk about the sort of relief that's being provided and the signal you're sending to the rest of the industries in the marketplace.
You're right. It's not about whether the public likes a particular industry. We don't want our economy to collapse totally, come out of this thing while we're all healthy health-wise, and economically we're a basket case. So I find it interesting, too, Dan, that I've already begun to be hassled by some listeners who will say, what are you talking about with economic money for companies? I thought you believed in capitalism and that companies should make it on their own or not make it. And I do believe in that until the government tells the company they can't do business. Capitalism works when it's allowed to work, but right now it can't. This is an unprecedented situation health-wise and economically.
I want to make sure you know about this so you can inform your listeners. Speaking of taking the advice of medical professionals, Dr. Oz prescribes
yeah.
regular sex for quarantine couples. That's good for your health. So
really? I got to go.
Yeah, pass that on to Mrs. Agar and your listeners as well. Jerry Agar, Toronto Sun columnist, host of the Jerry Agar Show on News Talk 1010 CFRB in Toronto. Jerry, always a pleasure. Say hi to Ryan Reynolds for us.
Thanks very much.
Separated. Hey, the man, you're disrespecting me. Take them out. You gotta keep them separated.
Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and we'll have some of the highlights from the briefing today from President Trump and his coronavirus task force in just a minute. But first, talk a little bit about the American mentality towards the pandemic and how people demonstrate who they are in times of crisis. For more on this, interesting piece in Spectator, spectator.us, about how pandemics change the way we think, from Melissa Chen, who's the New York editor for Spectator USA. Melissa, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So this piece prompted by obviously some public reaction as the virus became more and more prevalent in people's lives. And now, of course, we're, you know, into the full national, state, local, and individual response to the spread of this virus. And so just, you know, to, as you tried to take a step back to make some observations about the nature of man in these times of crisis, what did you reflect upon?
Yeah, I was interested in the psychology of it all. You know, how would this constant drip of news about this impending crisis, this outbreak, how would that affect our collective psychology, our psychology of individuals? And then down the road, downstream of that, how that affects our politics and other, you know, macro trends. So what I found was, you know, there was a suite of psychological mechanisms called the behavioral immune system. And what it does is that it allows us to avoid pathogen threats before we get infected. So the idea is that evolutionarily, the reason why we developed this suite of psychological tools was so we never got to the point where we would be infected by a virus in the first place. We would be able to detect this person is, you know, potentially infected. How do we avoid this person? And all of this is very subconscious. And the whole suite of behaviors is known as the behavioral immune system. And it affects everything from how you would like to date, you know, your choice for who you would want to vote for at a ballot box. All of this is when you prime somebody with you know, thinking about germs and they feel that they are threatened, they change their preferences and it manifests on very different levels.
Well, so one, you know, example on a public health, public safety as level, thinking about when the AIDS epidemic struck and you had, of course, people talking about abstinence in some cases or certainly wearing protection in other cases to avoid the likelihood of transmitting the HIV virus. When it comes to something that is airborne like this contagion, then it, the response is the social distancing that the nation is now hotly debating.
Correct. It's social distancing, but the other thing that we're also now predisposed to is conforming behaviors. So when you have a pathogen threat, people who are individualists, people who don't, you know, they tend to break the status quo and don't listen to instructions, they tend to be threats. And so what you have is people start behaving in a way that conforms to a group mean set of behaviors. So, for example, because the directive has been you got to social distance yourself 6 feet away from, you know, the next person if possible, anyone that doesn't do that, that's been violating this, is seen as somebody that needs to, you know, an individualist who's too dangerous and needs to be punished. And we tend to use, you know, tactics such as shaming to call this person out because this person acting this way now becomes a huge threat to our own personal safety and our own health. And so you see conformist behaviors kind of take root in the population.
And well, I'll tell you what, when we come back, I want to develop that a little bit more, the behavioral immune system that you're describing and guards sort of our instinctual disease avoidance behaviors, how that influences our political attitudes and choices at the ballot box. That's sort of intriguing. In addition to distinguishing between, you know, instinctive or rational behavioral or behavioral immune system responses that are in the interest of, you know, self-preservation and those that are just in the interest of trying to prosecute a political point of view. More with Melissa. Yeah, I know there are distinctions there. Melissa Chen, more with Melissa Chen, a New York editor for Spectator USA right after this.
Go.
fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Melissa Chen. She is the New York editor for Spectator USA, and she's written this provocative piece, How Do Pandemics Change the Way We Think? Having an interesting discussion about the behavioral immune system, as she was describing it, how it's responsible for guiding our disease avoidance conduct. And you also write, less understood about the BIS, is how it may affect our political attitudes and thus our electoral choices. And I just wanted you to develop that a bit more.
Yeah, it's been found that disease threats can predict preferences for physically attractive leaders, especially when people are primed to think about germs. They tend to prefer young candidates and healthy looking candidates and physically attractive candidates. And in my piece, I said that the black swan candidate, therefore, was actually Tulsi Gabbard, because you know, at the time Bernie was still pretty much in running, but now it's pretty clear that it's going to be Biden, but that would mean both our choices are in the high risk category for COVID-19.
Right. So people will sort of subconsciously make an assessment correct about which candidate looks healthiest, strongest, and then make that connection to sort of ability to lead in these
exactly,
precarious
because,
times.
Because physical attractiveness tends to be a proxy, an imperfect proxy for fitness, and it's the same reason why dating preferences also change. So, if you prime people to think about diseases, they tend to prefer mates that have better symmetry on their faces, because that is a sign of evolutionarily fit genes. So it's for the same reason.
But is that heightened in a situation where there has been a viral threat or a viral outbreak, or there's a time of crisis, or is that just, does it really spike more than it is just naturally in every election?
So actually what they do is when they do these studies, they're done in labs. So they're priming people to think about it, and then they're asking them to rate who they would vote for, who they would date. So they're giving them conditions of elevated disease threats and then seeing how they vote, how they make their decisions after.
Interesting. And then this other issue, too, because there's been, so much argument about the terms you use to describe coronavirus. Are you allowed to say the Wuhan virus, the China virus? Is that the foreign virus? Is that some sort of, veiled shot at the other, and it's xenophobic and this and that? And then it's the behaviors like, I'm not going to go to a restaurant, and this is before we were on lockdown in cities, but so several weeks ago, I'm not going to go to any restaurant in Chinatown because the virus seemingly emanated from Wuhan, China. So I'm going to make the connection that, anything Chinese related is a threat to my health. It seems to me, on the one hand, you can call something what it is based on where it emanated. I mean, German measles, Wuhan virus, whatever. And it's another thing to say, before we're in this period, that I'm not going to a Chinese restaurant from that's run by a Chinese family that's been in America as long as I have because the virus started in Wuhan.
Right. You know what's funny? I mean, I'm Chinese, and I know Chinese people in my family who wouldn't go to Chinese restaurants when this first happened, because what's happening is we're using that as a proxy, right? It's, again, it's an imperfect proxy, but we're trying to avoid people that we know are likely to have traveled to China or be interacting with other people who have gone back and forth between China and the U.S. So that's what you're evaluating for, because those are the people likely to be carrying that contagion anyway. And this was during the time, it's February, and we're looking at the Chinese New Year Festival, and there's good reason to think that many people here might be going back to their homeland for or to visit relatives for Chinese New Year. And if they do that, or, you know, they're more likely to encounter people that were traveling in and out of China or even near Wuhan. So there was good reason to avoid Chinatown, at least in the early, like you said, like in the month of February, before this entire pandemic spread like wildfire to Italy and beyond. And you know, it does show like that pathogen cues increase our sense of xenophobia and ethnocentrism during during these elevated disease threats. And the reason is just that interaction with any sort of foreign or exotic people tends to increase your risk of exposure to foreign parasites, right? Back in the 15th century, that happened when the European settlers came and inadvertently brought smallpox and decimated quite a large swath of the Native American population.
So, I mean, it is like a sensible, instinctive self-preservation.
It's instinctive.
You're thinking about, right, social networks. You're not thinking about this Chinese restaurant proprietor who I know. You're thinking about, I know he goes back and forth to China a couple times a year. I know he's got extended family that visit him. And it'd be the same thing if we were based on the caseload right now and the incidence of death in Iran. If you had Iranian friends or there was an Iranian neighborhood or, Italy, the same sort of thing. If you knew about these sort of the penchant for the social interaction, the penchant for travel back and forth, you'd have the same reaction. So it's much less about the particular race or the particular country of origin, and it's much more about the idea of the socialization and the threat level that poses.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. Well, that makes sense. It's a really interesting way to think about it, because the other way of just saying, you say Wuhan virus, or you say you're not going to Chinatown, is because you don't like Chinese people. Well, that's just stupid, right? I mean, that's way too simplistic. That's not what's going on here. I all of a sudden don't like the Chinese restaurant that I otherwise always go to. No, of course not. There's something else at play here. And so you've sort of helped to provide the psychological explanation for it. So that's tremendously helpful, which is why what we try to do on this show, have a little bit of value-added information. Melissa Chen, New York editor for Spectator USA, How Do Pandemics Change the Way We Think? Check that out. I'll tweet it out at Dan Prof Show. Thank you so much for joining us, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Take care.
Thanks for having me. Rebel, rebel, put on your dress. Rebel, rebel, your face is a mess. Rebel, rebel, after they know. Hot tramp, I love you so.
You listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. I want to go back to today's briefing by President Trump and the entire coronavirus task force, the topic of testing. Both Vice President Pence as well as Dr. Deborah Birx weighed in on this. Vice President Pence talking about this public-private partnership that's enhancing the production of testing kits, analysis those testing kits so that we have a better handle on the spread of the virus.
I'm pleased to report that we're increasing the number of tests being performed by the thousands every day, thanks to the public-private partnership that President Trump forged with commercial laboratories around the country. Our health experts tell us to remind every American, it's important to remember, people without symptoms should not get tested. We want to make sure that the supply of testing is there for those that need it most or are symptomatic or in the vulnerable population.
Now, I still go back. I'm not so sure. I understand that now. I'm no infectious disease expert, but there are others who have opined on the topic we discussed on this show that suggest it would be better to do random sampling, including those that are asymptomatic, just so you can better inform the models. And maybe you could inform the models such that you don't have worst case scenarios dominating the headlines from the Imperial College in London projection. Worst case scenario, 2.2 million Americans and 500,000 Brits could die if nothing was done. Well, if extreme measures weren't taken, well, things are being done, and arguably quite extreme measures have been taken and are continuing to be taken. So projecting out the millions dead, hundreds of thousands dead. I don't know how helpful that is, but I do know that if you got better sample data to inform the modeling, you might get a better handle on exactly what the trajectory of this is. Now, Dr. Deborah Birx also wanted to make a point about testing, understanding that they previously, with the CDC being the only repository, slow throughput in terms of getting the results. And so there are test kits that were waiting to go through the diagnostic for determination. Now that they have this private platform that's in 2,000 laboratories around the country that she referenced yesterday, referenced again today, there's going to be quicker processing of the tests. And so over the next couple of days, you're going to see the number of diagnoses, the number of positives go up perhaps significantly because you're processing 5 or 6 days worth of tests in 48 hours. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's extending faster than the models predict. It's just that you have essentially a bottleneck of kits waiting to be diagnosed that are going to be diagnosed very quickly and thus included in the body of data.
It will be 5 to 6 days worth of tests being run in 24 to 48 hours. So our curves will not be stable until sometime next week.
And she made the point, you know, before people, particularly in the media, run out and say, you know, we're where Italy was, this comparison that people are trying to force the United States versus Italy and the competing trajectories and the severity of the incidence of infection, not to mention hospitalization and death. You know, just hold back as data comes online, as models are adjusted, as we get a little bit more extension of the sampling and the testing over the next week to get a better, clearer picture rather than unnecessarily inducing panic.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Is there something we can learn from South Korea? South Korea, along with Singapore, have been held up as the model for addressing the coronavirus outbreak. Basketball games in South Korea are being scheduled to resume the end of this month, though in empty arenas. Let's just hold the phone on South Korea. Science magazine piece looking at trying to answer the question, what's the secret to South Korea's success? Country of 50 million people appears to have greatly slowed its epidemic. It reported only 74 new cases as of the writing of this article yesterday, down from 909 at its peak at the end of February. And it's done so without locking down entire cities or taking some of the other authoritarian measures that helped China bring its epidemic under control. In fact, the president of South Korea saying it's a democratic republic. We feel a lockdown is not a reasonable choice. And so it was diagnostic testing that has been reported widely to have been the key to controlling the outbreak. Diagnostic testing, identifying who's infected, and then obviously the quarantine. That's the second piece of it. But there was some subtext that was lost in a lot of the reporting. So people understandably looking, is this a model I can replicate? Is this a model I can replicate? Do they have they figured it out? Can we? I get it. The testing, they're testing 10,000 people a day. And they did. They tested more than any other country. 270,000 people in a 50 million person country. It's significant. When we started getting more of the reporting back, we found a lot of the testing was false positives for other respiratory illnesses, not COVID-19. Nonetheless, it still looks like they've, at minimum, flattened the curve, to borrow a Tony Fauciism. However, these are scientists writing in Science magazine. Are they scheduled for another outbreak? Whether the success will hold is unclear. New case numbers are declining largely because of the Herculean effort to investigate a massive cluster of more than 5,000 cases, 60% of the nation's total, near a particular mega church in that country. New clusters, the Science magazine reporting, new clusters are now appearing. Since last week, authorities have reported 129 new infections, most linked to a call center in Seoul. This could be the initiation of a community spread, and the region of Seoul is home to 23 million people. And it goes on to talk about the lessons they learned from MERS. So I'm not saying that South Korea hasn't done a lot of the right things since the outbreak, and I'm not saying that they're going to have another outbreak, or they're not going to be able to contain it the way that they seem to have, get on that downside of that flattened curve, as we're learning the vernacular. But I'm just, you know, you have scientists that are watching this in the detail that's required, looking at measures taken and actual consequences rather than just measuring the volume or assessing the volume of measures taken. You have to look at what the results you're getting, too, and how those results may change. You think you've got it licked one day, and now a cluster pops up near a call center near a call center in Seoul. So, you know, all of this is just a way to, again, like, exercise restraint, talk about what we know to be true, and continue to ask the questions about what we hope to understand to be true or false, so that we can be informed in the decisions we make and the information we share. And so this is why you have to rely on people who, you know what they're talking about, which generally means not politicians. Cleveland Clinic CEO Dr. Tom Mihaljevic, he was on with Maria Bartiromo talking about another issue that I think there's a lot of panic around, which is the healthcare infrastructure in this country. Could it handle the kind of level of infections that some modeling is predicting? Here's what the Cleveland Clinic CEO said.
Healthcare systems have their own contingency and emergency preparedness and have developed plans to ramp up our capacity and availability of space and ventilators appropriately. At this moment, healthcare systems have more than enough capacity to serve all of those in need.
So it's not doing one thing, it's synchronizing all the things. I think that needs to be driven home in a way that it's not being done as effectively as it could be. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Bradley Blakeman. He's former deputy assistant to President George W. Bush, principal of the 1600 Group, and adjunct professor of public policy and international affairs at G-Town. That would be Georgetown University. Bradley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So as somebody who was a deputy assistant to a president, how would you assess the response from the all of the professionals, including, of course, the President of the United States, to this point, and the communication of what's being done to bring people along every step of the way?
As somebody who was in the White House on 9/11, I have witnessed firsthand the response of a crisis to a proportion that our country had not seen, an attack on America. This is the equivalent of that and more, because this is affecting every American directly, unforeseen and silent enemy. I think the president has done a great job of getting professionals surrounding him who can give him good decisions that he can make. He's made good decisions, tough decisions, and I think so far so good. I'd like a cop on every corner, but that is not doable. What we have to make sure is the cops are there and the medical people are there for the people who need it the most. And everybody else needs to stand down and follow direction. And at a time of crisis, you're only as good as those making decisions and those who will follow them.
One of the things that seems to me, just in terms of the media coverage, of course, everybody focuses on the president and the federal level, except when states start doing things like, locking down bars and restaurants and potentially locking down an entire city the way San Francisco has, or a state the way that Pennsylvania has. But I liked your piece, The Hill, the other day about local pharmacies and the role that local pharmacies have to play in this, much like we talk about the role that state and local governments have to play. All our hopes and dreams and preventative measures don't emanate from the federal government, which is why they're promulgating guidelines, not edicts. And you have to make intelligent decisions at the local level, within our decentralized, freer society than most. And so when the president last week at his Friday briefing had the CEOs of, the big pharma companies and, the home healthcare companies, but also CVS and Walgreens there, the role that pharmacies have to play in helping us get to the other side of this.
There's no doubt. We know that 95% of Americans live within 5 miles of a retail pharmacy. It's not necessarily a CVS. It could be a small community pharmacy.
Right.
And those caregivers and suppliers are right in their neighborhoods. They know their pharmacist. They visit there regularly for product or for prescription. And it makes good sense to cut the red tape and let the pharmacy step up and deliver wellness and also deliver health care and prescriptions and testing. This makes perfect sense. They're everywhere. They're known to the citizens. The citizens visit there regularly. And what we need to do is make sure that healthcare is provided in the safest, simplest, easiest, affordable way to the people who need it most. And a person going to a pharmacy for a test is one less person going to a hospital or a clinic or a doctor and taking up space from somebody who really needs that kind of attention. It just makes perfect sense. Out of this pandemic, we're gonna better our healthcare system.
Well, that's where I wanted to go too, because to use the war metaphor that too many are using, so I'll just join in. We have a tendency when we're talking about actual war to fight the last war. That was some criticism lodged against President George W. Bush and how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were prosecuted. What lessons did we learn from Gulf War I? Maybe not enough of them. And sort of the same thing here. And I go back to South Korea and the discussion of the lessons they learned from the MERS outbreak that they're applying or attempting to apply to the coronavirus outbreak. And so the same thing in the healthcare space. What lessons have we learned from the viral outbreaks of the last two or three decades that we're applying now or that will apply to future pandemics? And you point out the retail pharmacies as one of those.
Absolutely. And it just makes such sense that we should be empowering businesses who can step up more. They're willing to do it. They have the capacity to do it. They already have the infrastructure. So why not provide more services locally and free up hospitals? And we know that beds are a premium, especially those in ICU, and deliver services in a much better and efficient way to people who need it, and give, most importantly, peace of mind to people that they know where they need to go. And at times of emergency, the best thing to do is to free up the system because the people who need it most are the people who should get the care. And I'm pleased that President Trump has cut through red tape quickly. I'm pleased that the small, medium, and large pharmacies have willingly taken on this responsibility. And we are going to be well more prepared for this event as it proceeds, but more importantly in the future, this is going to be much easier to respond to because we're going to have testing centers. We're going to have the ability for wellness care at a delivery point that's much more accessible to the people.
He is Bradley Blakeman, former deputy assistant to President George W. Bush from 01 to 04, principal of the 1600 Group, adjunct professor of public policy and international affairs at Georgetown University. Check out his piece at thehill.com, which I'll tweet out at Dan Proft about retail pharmacies. Very good. Bradley Blakeman, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to the Dan Proft Show. For those in the D.C. press corps, big fans of China, you know, like Tom Friedman, New York Times. If only we could be more like them, more autocratic and communist. Ministry of Foreign Affairs demanding all U.S. nationals working for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, whose credentials expire by year's end, turn those credentials in within the next 10 days.
Huh.
They won't be allowed to report anywhere in China, including the semi-autonomous territories of Hong Kong and Macau. And you're sure you want to believe the official story coming out of China? Also, Iran, obviously another totalitarian state, the lead state sponsor of terror the world over, they did what China did, which was to ignore the virus when it first started to present. They are now up to 1,100, round numbers, 1,100 dead, 17,000 cases. Let's remember the societies that are combating this effectively and will come out the other side as best as is humanly possible, as compared to those that for some reason capture the imagination of way too many in our press corps that have, unfortunately, outsized voices of influence in our culture. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Grady Means, contributor to The Hill, Washington Times, San Fran Chronicle. He served in the White House as a policy assistant to Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. Grady, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
It's really interesting, and it's sad, obviously, because nobody's rooting for anybody to get sick or die. But it is interesting to note how different societies are handling this differently and the differing consequences. And I know you have a piece coming out this morning on precisely that topic.
Well, I do. It's funny. Probably 100 years ago, maybe a little less, a journalist, H.L. Mencken, said for every complicated problem, there's an answer that's simple, direct, and wrong. And a lot of the mainstream media seems to sort of follow that directly. They find answers that are simple, direct, and wrong. And so they get very enthusiastic about authoritarian answers, quick answers, top-down answers, which on the face of it, you think maybe are going to be effective. And then in the end, it turns out to be ham-fisted, not using enough information, and completely ineffective in the end. And, you know, there have been a number of folks who have written over the past several decades about the clash of civilizations, who will win. The term first came up when we were facing an increased rise of Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. And people said, will America survive? We're wide open. We're vulnerable. You know, we look like a sitting duck. How will we do? And I think we're getting a firsthand test of that right now. And I think the bottom line is we're doing pretty well. I mean, we're an open society. We're a free market society. It always looks chaotic. We're arguing about it. Everybody has an opinion. There's not one community in America that isn't arguing about social distancing, isn't arguing about all of these things. Everybody's an expert. Everybody's an epidemiologist. And yet, we seem to be moving forward very quickly. People seem to be social distancing. There are some exceptions, of course. Spring break in Florida is a notable one. But in general, across the country, people have bought into it, and they're moving forward. And it looks like we're awfully, awfully responsive, awfully quick. We may well have the best response and the least damage of anywhere in the world. So I think if you really were to total up clash of civilizations, you'd have to say America so far looks like it's a pretty good model, even though the press is not happy because the answer is not simple. It's not direct, but it certainly is wrong.
Given all the Chinese propaganda, Grady, do you have any perspective on where you think the virus originated other than Wuhan?
Who knows? There's so many theories about that. And of course, you're wondering about what the source is and if there's a hidden hand and an intent. And there's really no way of knowing. Probably just as well for the moment for most people to accept the conventional view that somehow it percolated up in Wuhan. Maybe it leaked from a bio lab there. Maybe it came from a wet market there. Maybe somebody just wound up getting bit by a bat. It's extremely hard to know what happened. But what is important is, regardless of what happened, it's important to learn from it. It is a blueprint for asymmetric warfare. Regardless of where it came from, there is no doubt that military planners, strategists in Beijing and Moscow and Tehran, in strange places throughout the world, in the Middle East, are studying it and studying everybody's reaction and trying to see if they could launch a more serious attack and a more planned attack. Because honestly, the damage has been astounding. It's been astoundingly quick, literally trillions of dollars lost in global markets.
And weaponizing this sort of virus is, as you say, as sort of known in terrorist circles, the poor man's nuclear weapon. That's what they're searching for.
They've been planning something like this for years, terrorists have. I'm not saying this is a terrorist attack at all. But certainly they're learning from it, and they're seeing that, yes, it actually has an astounding impact. And it is relatively easy to launch compared to what it would take to launch any large weapons of mass destruction attack. Nuclear attack, of course, takes gigantic money and huge planning and logistics. An EMT attack, which would dislodge our electronic grids, also takes tremendous effort, tremendous planning. But launching a bioweapons attack is cheap. It could be planted quite easily. You know, an extremely clever terrorist and you know, our enemies are extremely clever. Even the small terrorist groups, they could well have sent an agent into Wuhan, and it would be very clever because everybody would suspect the Chinese. And then it could go from there, and it would cost nothing. And it would, as you can see, it would have devastating impact on the world.
Going back to media coverage of this crisis, I find it rather ironic that for a media, for a press corps, and frankly for a party, that decried President Trump as a king or someone attempting to be a king, now they're criticizing him for not being one.
Well, consistency is not their strong suit, certainly.
Yes.
And certainly, obviously, isn't the strong suit of the Democratic candidates, since they seem to switch positions on this by the minute. that is ironic. In many ways, I think Trump has handled it well. The notion that he should be dictating this from above replicates the Chinese experience, which is not a happy ending so far. I mean, basically, Trump and the people throughout our governmental chain, through state government and local government, have adopted, in fact, a fairly sophisticated, it doesn't look sophisticated, but a fairly sophisticated approach of letting the decisions be made close to where the action is, where the real problems are. I never thought I'd say these words, but I was extremely impressed with the way Governor Cuomo in New York has been handling this by not stepping in, not closing from the state level all the schools, telling the folks locally that they should take control of it. I mean, suddenly Cuomo has become a federalist, which you would never have believed. And really, what it reflects is the real strength of our federal system, where we do let things, to the degree we can, occur from the bottom up, let local communities find the right solutions. They all certainly have tremendous amounts of information, and they've had a lot of debate. And frankly, I think there's a tremendous irony here, because the Democratic candidates throughout the primaries have been criticizing the Electoral College, talking about centralizing everything, it all should be run by, the popular vote. And yet what we're seeing here is that federalism actually works extremely well. There's a reason for the way America is structured. There's a reason for things as quaint as the Electoral College and equal representation in the Senate. We have to have strength emanate from the local levels. And if there's one hidden message, which the press does not get, is the federal system actually has inherent strength that other systems around the world are not showing in the same way.
He is Grady Means. He's a contributor to The Hill, Washington Times, and San Fran Chronicle. Served in the White House as a policy assistant to Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. Grady, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Do you come from a land down under?
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Your temper getting a little frayed in this era of coronavirus? You seeing instances of others arguing about what proper social distancing is? Seeing somebody act recklessly in terms of not covering their mouth when they cough or sneeze? You're in line for, a food pickup or on election day in three states yesterday to vote. And you're seeing some tension among Americans in terms of social interaction in the era of social isolation, hopefully the temporary era, fleeting era. Reuters reporting from sidewalk shouting matches to politically fueled online sniping. Tempers showed signs of fraying in some U.S. cities as the nation stepped up its response to the coronavirus pandemic. Get a little stir crazy, get a little anxious, maybe get a little short tempered. One such story, flatten the curve, go home, flatten the curve, go home. A man in Brooklyn yelled out of the window of a four-story apartment building as people walked on the street below. And neighbors soon joined in the chiding chorus. It was just sort of odd, people screaming down at people walking on the street, but okay. Joanne Wasserman, 65-year-old communications consultant, tried to break the monotony of days indoors on Sunday by going for a walk through her Brooklyn neighborhood. While she took care to avoid crowds, she was surprised to see a gaggle of people in their 20s and 30s standing outside a packed restaurant. With her heart racing, she summoned the courage to confront these young people. Are you guys aware of what's going on? The response she received was, quote, "We're trying to have a nice Sunday, so why don't you just frack off?" Okay. All right. There you go. Good conversation. Brotherly love. But there is this intergenerational deal with coronavirus, particularly in on days of would-be celebration like St. Patrick's Day and St. Patrick's Day weekend, and the weekends in general. Wall Street Journal also reporting the quote-unquote generational war brewing over coronavirus across Europe, where social life is shutting down faster than in the U.S. Many young people, don't want to abide the diktats of the authorities. For example, in Berlin, which is a hotspot for nightclubs, authorities ordered the closure of all bars and clubs over the weekend. Many establishments ignored the decree, forcing police to forcibly shut down some 63 establishments across the city. One statistician at the France's health ministry, "They're preventing us from living," 30-year-old statistician, actually works for the French government. The French government has essentially put the country in shutdown. In Italy, which has been on lockdown for days, young people, especially students, face a choice between returning their parents' homes or remaining cooped up in small apartments desperate for social outlets. And, they talk about the culture of social engagement, and they're also, of course, less risk averse. There's the more of the feeling of invincibility that everybody understands among people in their teens and 20s and even 30s that maybe I'll get the flu. But that's all this is. As a young person, I'm not really vulnerable, and I'm not giving much consideration to people that are a little bit older who are more vulnerable. And so this is fraying nerves. And one wonders if this could lead to a realignment, a social realignment. One is in the way that we think about our political leaders. And another is sort of the way that we interact with each other in this polarized area. The good news, as Sam Abrams, political science professor at Sarah Lawrence College, writes at the Dispatch, the good news is that most Americans want to cooperate in an emergency, willing to help their neighbors. He writes, my own survey work has shown that 3/4 of Americans are likely to cooperate in an emergency, even higher numbers willing to help their neighbors in a crisis, and still believe in the American dream. They're turning away, Americans are turning away from national politics to support local mayors and municipalities, regardless of partisanship, because Americans are pragmatic. And this was his larger point about a political realignment, not seen since perhaps, depending on how you define realignments, the realignment after the Great Depression. He just talks about this idea of pragmatism, this idea of government closest to the people, this discussion we've been having about federalism, rediscovering the genius of federalism and subsidiarity through this crisis, and this against the backdrop of increasing mistrust of national political leaders, increasing polarization over national political leaders and national political parties. And he writes in conclusion, without suggesting exactly what the realignment would look like, there's a hunger in this nation for something more. And COVID-19 may finally be the tipping point for communities to organize and for realignment to emerge. Americans are turning away from partisanship. We're going through a huge generational demographic change. Between COVID-19 fallout, disgust with the political status quo, we may very well see a new, reasonable coalition rise over the next few months to alter and realign the current entrenched polarized state. The nation is ready. That's a hopeful note, and you look for hopeful notes in these times of distress. But the nation is ready for what exactly? Yes, okay, I understand the polarization. Yes, okay, I understand the loss of brand equity by both parties. Yes, okay, I understand the negative partisanship that's attendant to a presidential election in particular. You've got some very different attitudes from other survey research about how a free society should be ordered. And those who believe it should be ordered based on the system in which force is the feature, like socialism.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and it's not just been a run on toilet paper, also a run on guns and ammo. AP reporting the world's largest gun store in Metro Atlanta, lines 6 to 8 people deep. Gun store in L.A. had lines stretched down the block. At least one store in Idaho put limits on sales after its shelves were nearly cleared out. You've got people making a run on guns and ammo in this era of I guess the prospect of some sort of post-coronavirus or during coronavirus Lord of the Flies, survival of the fittest Hobbesian world in which some people think we're going to live. Not to say that you can't stock up on guns and ammo to protect yourselves, but I assume this is largely people who've already got protection at home, like myself. Anyway, it is interesting to note because maybe they were unintentionally prescient, particularly in big metro areas. I say this because of a couple of announcements coming out of big metro areas, starting with Philadelphia. Due to the coronavirus crisis, Philadelphia police will no longer be making arrests for all narcotics offenses, theft from persons, retail theft, theft of auto, I'm not done, burglary, vandalism, bench warrants, stolen autos, economic crimes such as passing bad checks, and fraud, and prostitution. It's worth noting that Philadelphia has one of those district attorneys that was George Soros' finance, Larry Krasner. We've talked about it on the show before. Here is another instance of where that turns out to be real important. And where I live in Chicago, of course, yesterday evening, we reelected effectively Kim Fox, the Jussie Smollett whisperer. She won the Democrat primary, and in Cook County, the Democrat primary is the general election. So she's going to continue to be our Cook County state's attorney for the next 4 years, also Soros financed. You've got another one out in San Francisco with that Chesa Boudin, George Soros financed. All of them, including Cy Vance in New York, interested in culture, promoting a culture of non-prosecution. And of course, that necessarily going to New York includes de Blasio, includes Cuomo, right? These are the architects of the quote-unquote bond reform. We're not going to bond people out. We're going to give them a burner phone and a cash card to wander around in the hopes that that incentivizes them to come back for their court date if they've committed nonviolent offenses, you know, like hate crimes against Jews. That's only a couple of months ago, remember? Well, going to New York, the city is considering freeing jailed suspects over the coronavirus. This from the Sandinista mayor, de Blasio, the same guy who over the weekend was talking about nationalizing hand sanitizer producers. Crisis prevents an opportunity for would-be despots to try to consummate their interest in being an autocrat, doesn't it? De Blasio is saying city officials evaluating right now people who might be particularly high risk in terms of vulnerability to the virus, not in terms of threat to the public. The inmate group would presumably include the elderly, those suffering from diabetes, asthma, heart disease, lung disease, and compromised immune systems, all identified as people vulnerable to the virus. In addition to those individuals, suspects deemed to be at low risk of committing new alleged criminal offenses could also be released. So just so you understand, there's a group that is being considered for release that is not necessarily nonviolent, that is not necessarily at low risk of committing additional crimes. And then in addition to that group, there is a group of suspects deemed to be low risk in terms of committing new crimes, and all are under consideration for release from Rikers Island. And of course, this move backed by the city's Board of Correction, as well as the Manhattan and Brooklyn DAs. Culture of non-prosecution and culture of non-incarceration. Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, just as a matter of course, right? Which has one of the most violent, it's one of the most per capita violent cities in America, twice as many murders in Chicago as in New York and L.A. combined. And Kim Fox has spent the last 4 years saying she was focusing all her resources on interdicting violent crime, which is why she couldn't spend time worrying about prosecuting Jussie Smollett for his hate crime hoax. You follow? I know it's not easy. And so going back to the original story of people around the country stocking up, I don't know so much it's required in Boise, Idaho, but in terms of Philly, San Fran, Chicago, L.A., New York. And by the way, as if the police don't have enough to do with respect to their day-to-day jobs in this coronavirus environment and with a law enforcement side that isn't interested in prosecuting lawbreakers, please, before this goes viral too, Newport Police Department in Oregon, they took to social media to plead with residents to stop calling 911 when they run out of toilet paper. It's hard to believe that we even have to post this. Do not call 911 just because you ran out of toilet paper. You will survive without our assistance. Yeah, some will, apparently. In a related story, bidet sales skyrocket amid coronavirus toilet paper shortage. I don't know what the concentration of newly purchased bidets is in Newport. But yeah, the police have better things to do. don't call them about toilet paper, don't call them about bidets, and don't call them about self-protection. Make sure that you provide for that yourself, particularly if you're in one of those communities contaminated by non-prosecution-oriented prosecutors. This is the Dan Prof.
You'll know. This is the Dan Prof. Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof. Show. Since we're all homeschoolers now, as Lindsay Burke writes at DailySignal.com, I thought with the kids at home in so many places, have a little discussion about online resources for those that are not used to homeschooling, not used to so much curriculum planning for the kids, depending on what level of engagement their schools have during this time when they're off in terms of assignments or resources. So far, 33 states that have closed some 64,000 schools, affecting 32.5 million students, according to Education Week. And of course, that number goes up with each passing day. But there is a great market of online resources that kids can access while they're at home, rather than just doing what I do and watching reruns of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Numerous companies such as Zurn and ST Math provide materials online for free. They're providing them online for free during coronavirus, during this outbreak. Of course, you have existing options such as the Khan Academy, which offer a wealth of educational resources. Apprenda Micro School is offering its coursework for families for just $100 for the remainder of the year. Other repositories of more resources, National School Choice Week, online resources categorized by content area. You can find online tools such as communication platforms, math, social studies, English, language arts, foreign language education. Daddy School is another recommendation. The other thing to point out, and there's a video from Chicago that underscores this. A lot of museums, educational institutions, have virtual visits that you can access online. So the National Gallery of Art in D.C. does, Guggenheim in New York does, 2,500 other museums that have partnered with Google to make their art and virtual tours available online. And the Shedd Aquarium is what I was referencing here. A video that's gone viral of the penguins at the Shedd Aquarium wandering around and visiting other aquatic life in the shed while it is shuttered. Also from J.D. Tusiel, who's Reason Magazine, a columnist, and a homeschooler, talking about teleschool, as perhaps some kids in public schools or private schools are getting used to that, or that's going to be part of the gap filling. Homeschoolers are so on that, he writes, or if they're not into teleschooling, they have a stack of books and papers, kitchen counter science experiments, video lectures, the list goes on, and much of it adds up to the social distancing measures of which teleschooling is supposed to be a part. So there you go. You can always lean on the homeschooling family in your life. But he also points to other resources that you can access. Classic literature is available for free in electronic format through Project Gutenberg. He also mentioned Khan Academy. He adds the American Chemical Society gives away a complete chemistry curriculum and a variety of lessons that are freely available from the National Endowment for the Humanities, EdSitement portal. And so go through all of these resources that are being promoted by people who know, who are in the homeschooling business I mean, it might be a resource not only to fill the gap for now, but to enhance the education they're otherwise getting when they do go back to school. Everybody be COVID-19 free. Have a safe day and join us again tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us on The Dan Prof Show.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is The Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.